We are looking at Baptists in England, and we had just finished yesterday with Queen Elizabeth and the act by which she declared herself the supreme authority for the church. That's Roman numeral 6, roughly page 75. And she had declared herself the supreme authority and demanded that nothing be preached against her will. Okay. So we pick up this morning, next paragraph. Baptists had quickly grown into a strong and visible minority in England. A strong and visible minority. But Elizabeth would take care of that. She established a commission with the responsibility to destroy the independent churches. And again, Baptists were burned at the stake in England. Now, she could not wipe them out, but here's the contrast with the statement I just made. They became a strong and visible minority. They were building church buildings. They're out in the public. They were where folks could see them. What happens when Elizabeth starts to persecute them? Back to the mountains, to the forests. Where she wasn't able to keep them from existing, but they weren't a visible minority anymore. Robert Brown, known as the father of the Congregationalist, became a prominent preacher in England during this time. He studied with some Dutch Baptists in Norwich, England. Brown became convinced of all of the Baptist distinctives except believers' baptism. He became convinced of all the Baptist distinctives except believers' baptism. Consequently, he helps to call the public's attention to a number of important doctrines, but not baptism by immersion of believers only. And in fact, D.L. Moody of Chicago area fame, who was originally reached for Christ in a Congregationalist church, was never baptized by immersion. Because of the fact that was his influence, Congregationalist. So you certainly couldn't call him a Baptist, but he was a preacher of the gospel, and he certainly helped to call people's attention to some important truths, especially the independence of the church. And he became convinced of all the Baptist distinctives except believers' baptism, and his preaching led to the formation of many independent churches in England. These independent churches stood nobly for religious liberty and separation of church and state, even though it brought them severe persecution. Each of these independent churches decided for themselves about baptism. They were often called, some were Baptist and some practiced infant baptism. They were often called Congregationalist churches because of their emphasis on independent churches composed of believers who governed their own affairs. In other words, the congregation was, humanly speaking, the authority, not some outside organization, not some headquarters, not some ruler. There was often fellowship between the Baptist and the early Congregationalist. And when I say that, usually the fellowship was between with the Congregationalists that believed in baptism by immersion. And that group would fade and fade over the years. Years ago, I remember preaching in a Congregationalist church here in Illinois that practiced baptism by immersion and would emphasize the Baptist distinctives and so forth, but I haven't come across a Congregationalist church like that in a long, long time. The difference between the Baptists and the evangelical Protestants is made clear by the case of Bishop Hooper of the Church of England, who came to the conclusion that Scripture must be seen as the sole authority. Hooper began to preach that truth and asked the Church of England to conform its practices to the doctrine. Now watch this. He's preaching the Bible is the only authority. But where is he preaching it at? In the Church of England. And by the very fact that you're in the Church of England means you have what? Another authority. Okay? So he's asking the Church of England to reform. But if the Church of England was to practice that doctrine, it would cease to exist. He was rebuked and reminded that both the ruling monarch and the church leadership are authorities. Are authorities. And a ruling monarch, of course, is an authority, but not over the church. He was also reminded that the sole authority of Scripture might even rule out infant baptism, which is how you became a member of the Church of England. I say, if you begin to practice sole authority of Scripture, wonder how many people are going to ask where baby baptism is in the New Testament. And, of course, the answer being nowhere. He was ordered to stop such preaching or leave the Church of England and identify with the Baptists. Identify with the Baptists who had always stood for the sole authority of Scripture. Sadly, he stayed in the Church of England and modified his doctrine. But, I mean, this was a huge thing. This was a bishop, not a local parish pastor. This was a huge thing because if you adopted this, if the Bible is the only authority, what authority does denominational headquarters have? None. So for denomination to adopt this principle would destroy the denomination. The persecution under Elizabeth was so severe that Baptists, Congregationalists, Quakers, and other independents began to flee to the forests and mountains again. Again, back to the mountains. After Elizabeth's death, her second cousin, King James of Scotland, became the English king. And this is King James of King James Version fame. One of the severest criticisms you often hear of him is that during his reign, Baptists were burned at the stake. And that is true. But that's not the whole story. Early in his reign, two Baptists were burned at the stake. Upon seeing this, King James said, never again. It's King James that ends the policy of executing Baptists. Now, obviously, it would have been better if he'd ended it a little bit quicker. But nonetheless, if you're going to tell the story of the Baptists who were burnt, you have to tell the story it was King James who ended that policy. After King James ended the policy of executing Baptists, there's never a case of a Baptist being executed again, even by other kings who opposed them. So, if you're going to tell that story, tell the whole story. Baptists continued to be oppressed in England. However, James turned away from the past policy of executions and turned to imprisonment and fines. Baptists appealed to James for religious freedom. However, it was not granted. Now, again, he would have been a better king and a better man if he had granted it. But here you are in Europe, where every monarch is the head of the church in that country. And for the monarch to step away and say, you can have belong to whatever religion you choose, in their minds, that would completely destabilize the government. Later history would prove that's not true, but that was their thought process. Baptists appealed to James for religious freedom, however, was not granted. But following their appeal, James seemed to lose interest in persecuting them. He seemed to lose interest. There's really no involvement of his in the persecution after that. He did not stop various church leaders, from persecuting the Baptists. But he did not participate as he had previously. And participate as he had previously. Many Baptists fled to Holland, while others were permitted to participate in the new English colonies. On the Atlantic seaboard of North America. In 1614, Leonard Busher, Leonard Buscher, B-U-S-H-E-R, Leonard Buscher, a member of a Baptist church in England, wrote the first book published in England advocating religious liberty. Advocating religious liberty. Now, this is a book with more importance than some might imagine. It's not in print today. You couldn't buy a copy of it, not even in a used bookstore. It's been out of print for so long. However, here's where it's significant. He had to flee to Holland after it was published, so it would eventually return to England. His book greatly influenced John Milton, Paradise Lost. His book greatly influenced John Milton, who wrote admirably for religious liberty. His book greatly influenced John Milton and the political writer, John Locke. John Locke, L-O-C-K-E. So Milton and Locke are dramatically influenced for religious liberty by this book that does not have wide circulation. But Locke's political writings, including advocating religious liberty, have wide circulation. They're still in print today, and they greatly influence Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, and James Madison. Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, James Madison. In other words, Buscher's book doesn't have much influence, but he influences John Locke, and John Locke is going to have tremendous influence. So indirectly, you could give Buscher credit for religious liberty in the United States. Now granted, there's a trail he go through first. And this is simply a Baptist pastor writing a book, not expecting to have wide circulation like other books would have, but to influence some people for the truth. And man, does he influence some people for the truth. He may not influence very many, but the ones he would influence drastically. And you and I are living with the results of that today. The Declaration of Independence is basically a restatement. It's basically a restatement of Locke's political philosophy. Basically a restatement of Locke's political philosophy applied to the situation of the American colony. And including religious liberty. John Locke wrote, Declaration of Independence, basically a restatement of Locke's political philosophy applied to the situation of the American colonies. John Locke wrote, the Baptists were from the beginning the firm advocates of absolute liberty, just and true liberty, equal and impartial liberty. The Say Baptist episode. One of the most famous events of English Baptist history took place during this time. It's often called the Say Baptist, capital S, E, dash, well, you see the in the title, dash Baptist episode. It means self-Baptist. John Smith, this is not the John Smith of Pocahontas fame, but a preacher named John Smith, had been a Church of England preacher who became convinced of sole authority of Scripture, separation of church and state. He left the Church of England, returned to his hometown of Gainsborough. In Gainsborough, there were two Congregationalist churches. One became the group from which most of the Pilgrim colonists to Plymouth Bay Colony came. Pilgrim colonists. Pilgrims were Congregationalists. Smith became the pastor of the other church. Because of persecution, the majority of the members of both churches fled to Holland. Fled to Holland. And while there, Smith became convinced of the truth of believers' baptism. He led his congregation to study this doctrine, and they agreed agreed, baptism by immersion, believers only, that's the biblical method. Now the question is, they're convinced of believers' baptism, who's going to baptize them? Okay. He baptized himself, and then most of the members of his congregation. And so folks begin still debate, was that legitimate baptism? Can you baptize yourself? And many Baptists would believe that since baptism is a local church ordinance, you have to have a local church baptizes, not a person. And that such a baptism would not be legitimate. And other folks would take the position that Smith took himself, was there was nobody here to do it. And so even today, it's not uncommon in Baptist colleges for that to be brought up as a debate point. Was this legitimate baptism? That would not be as significant if there weren't such cases today, particularly with the internet, of folks coming to grips with these truths that have never been in connection with the church. And so what do they do for baptism? It's a real question. And as the internet's influence grows, it becomes a bigger and bigger question. We have, some time back, baptized a young lady from Egypt who had been, her family had been studying the scriptures, and they'd been listening, they got saved listening to Trans World Radio, but they'd been going past that. That's just basically a gospel message. They had gone past that in their study and had come to believe that baptism by immersion of believers only was Bible baptism. They had no contact with any church. Their entire faith was based on the internet and the radio. And so when she had a chance in her early 20s to travel to the United States to Chicago, she came to Ravenswood and said, "Would you baptize me? I would like to be biblically baptized." Even though she was not going to be a permanent fixture at our church because she was only in the United States for 30 days. But we baptized her. We're confident in her testimony of salvation. I think her approach, waiting and praying that God would give her legitimate baptism, was better than John Smith's. I understand his. I understand what he was saying. But I think he'd have been better off to have waited till I had a moment where someone could give proper baptism. I've mentioned, I think, already here, and I just went through these pictures recently, of being in Syria and participating in a baptism. We baptized 19 people, most of which who were not from Syria. They had been saved. They did not have a church to attend. They were in communication with Baptist church there in Syria. Some of them, they flew in from United Arab Republic and Kuwait and so forth to be baptized by that church. Okay. Because they did not have a church handy. And I think John Smith had been better off to pray that God put him in touch with a church that could have done the baptism. But like I said, still debated today. Well, disputation arose over whether or not his baptism was legitimate, and he even began to question it over whether his baptism was legitimate. He presented himself to a Mennonite church for membership, and they would not recognize his self-baptism. And if someone presented me or came to me for church membership and that was the testimony of baptism, I don't believe I would accept it either. It appears he died while they were discussing how to handle the situation. Most of his church congregation applied for membership to the Mennonite church, and they were eventually admitted as members. A small number of the congregation did not want to join the Mennonites. They were led by Thomas Heulwiss. That's Thomas Heulwiss. You'll see the name in the next sentence. By Thomas Heulwiss, who became their pastor and continued to accept John Smith's baptism. They returned to England. Heulwiss formed a Baptist church. Heulwiss aggressively taught against the Calvinist doctrine of predestination. He taught aggressively against the Calvinist doctrine of predestination. because he strongly taught a general atonement. A general atonement. That Christ had died for all men. His church became known as a general Baptist church. Because he strongly taught a general atonement that Christ had died for all men, his church became known as a general Baptist church. Soon this name was applied to any Baptist church which taught a general atonement. Churches which taught that Christ died only for the elect, became known as particular Baptists. Christ died only for the elect, became known as particular Baptist. Particular Baptist. So for a period of time, every Baptist is put in that classification. General Baptist, you believe that Christ died for all men. Particular Baptist, you believe Christ only died for those he'd elected to save, just for particular individuals. But this becomes a designation that does not stay that way for long. Relatively soon, the people called General Baptists became people who believed that you could lose your salvation, that Christ died for everybody, but that you had to have a certain minimum level of works in order to stay saved. And so that created a situation, Arminians, where you, Arminians, you could lose your salvation, Calvinists who believe only a few were predestined, and most Baptists didn't fall into either category. Just as most Baptists don't fall into either category today. So pretty soon developed the terminology, and we'll get to it in another lesson, developed the terminology, we're not general Baptist, we're not particular Baptist, we're regular Baptists. Okay? In other words, we believe what Baptists have believed, and we've not been pulled aside this way, and we haven't been pulled aside this way, we're regular Baptist. And you see in the names, there were churches who would have the term regular Baptist in their name. Ironically enough, the regular Baptist would eventually get taken over by the Calvinists, yet distorting the identification again. But for a period of time, that's what regular Baptist meant. You're neither Arminian nor Calvinist. And you see some of the old names, like 1920s, when a group is being formed, and they're called the General Association of Regular Baptists. And we believe in a general atonement. We're regular Baptists. We're not Arminian or Calvinist. And like I said, you would see old abandoned church buildings in the South that have the name, it's not uncommon to see an old abandoned church building that has the name regular Baptist on it. Because that was common terminology once upon a time. And ironically, and we'll get to some of this in a bit, this is where you have to be so careful with names, because organizations don't stay the same. Eventually, the Calvinist would try and clay name to a regular Baptist. You actually had a case, they went all the way to the Supreme Court over who had the right to the name regular Baptist, and the Supreme Court ruled that the Calvinist did not have the right to the name. And so the Calvinists began to call themselves primitive Baptist. By primitive, they meant original. And so you will still see to this day, very commonly, primitive Baptist churches. That's the name. What they're saying is they're Calvinists. And so all the way to the Supreme Court, in a battle over who the name belongs to, and then a few decades later, the regular Baptists become Calvinists. Could have saved the trouble of the court case. And so normally, this is not 100% true. Normally today, when you see the name regular Baptist, it refers to a Calvinist. Even though it didn't in the beginning, the name developed to distinguish yourself from Calvinists. There was a court battle fought to keep that name from Calvinism. And yet today, most regular Baptist churches are Calvinist. And the lesson in all that, the issue is, it's not what a church or a movement is named. The definition of names come and go, and very often the defining characteristic of a movement when it first took its name will be gone a few decades later, or a century or two later, and the name will not mean the same thing at all. If you go to the Caribbean, several of the Caribbean countries, Bermuda, Bahamas, several of them, you see the name Spiritual Baptist a lot. The name Spiritual Baptist today means you call yourself Baptist, and all they mean by being Baptist is we baptize you by immersion, but you commune with the spirits. That is not the original meaning of the name, as you might guess. The voodoo practices come into the churches, take over the churches, and so just because you're in one of those Caribbean countries, say, here's a Baptist church. It may not be one you wish to attend. Okay? And that is why names have constantly been in a state of flux. Normally today, this is not 100%. We're living in the day in which this is starting to change. But normally today, when you talk about somebody that believes the Baptist distinctives, you'll call them an independent fundamental Baptist. I have become uncomfortable with that name because of the changes that are starting. I don't criticize anybody over it, but I use the term New Testament Baptist to describe myself. But you have names and their identifications and their meanings and their definitions come and go. And when you're reading church history, this can really be confusing. Because somebody says such and such believes this, and it's probably true at some point in their history, but you got to know at what point in their history for it to mean anything. And with the internet and the speed of rapid communication, the meaning of names no longer change slowly. They can change rapidly now. But anyway, that's how that terminology originally developed and what that terminology originally meant. Should be noted that historians sometimes differ on the details of the Say Baptist episode and the origin of general and particular Baptist. Some even deny that Smith and Hewlett were immersionists, but the evidence that they were legitimate Baptists is overwhelming. See John Christian's A History of the Baptists, where he goes into that in pretty considerable detail.